at the Air Force Academy for 6.5 years in that field. He then, or somewhere in that era, worked for NASA at Cape Kennedy in Florida at the height of the space program. Jerry only looks young. He has the rank of Brigadier General in the Air Force Reserve. He has one of the most beautiful, gracious wives in the world, 4 children, 3 grandchildren, 1 on the way this week. Other than those things, he and I are similar. So,
doesn't the Bible say something about lying? I did not ask him to do that. Well, during this about a 3/4 of an hour session, 3 of us would like to share a little bit of what the navigators are doing internationally. Now, the purpose of this conference is not to blow the navigator's horn, but it's to minister to you and to help you in your own lives. So a couple of years ago, because that has been our purpose right along, a couple of years ago we decided we're just going to virtually cut out the navigator information sessions here. We got more complaints than at any other time. For one thing, it's such a mystery. You know, people keep saying, what do you do? And who are you? And so part of what we're going to do is to try and lift some of that mystery. Today we'll concentrate on the international, and tomorrow on the United States. Terry Taylor will do that. Last week when I introduced this session, I said that the world is teetering on the edge of war. And, of course, today the world is in war. But, you know, that's really nothing new, because the world is constantly scarred with wars. I don't know what the number is, but it's you know, 30 or 40 or 50 wars going on at any one time, many of which you do not hear about because they don't affect you. But this one does. But, you know, there's another war that is going on, and it's a spiritual battle for the souls of men and women. And that is reality. Part of how he talked about it was reality. Do you ever get one of these notes from your kids, call home, quick, and it leaves you with a sinking feeling in your stomach? Well, I've taught my kids to say call home and then to say not an emergency. Well, just as I walked into the meeting where I was going to introduce Howie, or at the last meeting, I got one of those notes from our daughter Kathy. And so I stayed over in the sound booth because I wanted to... I just like to get these things taken care of quick and make sure. And I found out she wasn't there. She was next door at a neighbor's house. And then, so I just waited there until she called back because I sensed something was not quite right. And she has been sharing with this neighbor. And last night, in the middle of the night, this neighbor's 10-year-old girl died in her bed, in her sleep. And so Kathy was over there trying to help her and to comfort her and to help her through the first minutes. Her husband was away, he's in the Army, and he'll be back this afternoon. They're Catholic folks in background. And so I thought, that's reality. You know, and that's where she ought to be. Kath's going to join us, she and her husband, here tomorrow for a little time. But one thing that I thought is she said what she was doing. Is that Kathy was involved up to her eyebrows in a student ministry with the Navigators for 4 years. And if anyone knows how to help a person in some circumstances like this, both because of what she's been through and because of background, she can. See, it's for this reason that the Navigators exist. To reach and help people who are being oppressed in that kind of war. And our motto is to know Christ and to make him known. And that's what we want. And in that process, we want to reach them for Christ and then to help them grow spiritually and to reproduce their lives in others. Now, as an organization, we're 57 years old. And in these 6 decades, there have been certain steel threads that wend their way through our ministries all over the world. And the first is that motto that I said, to know Christ and to make him known. And that is our driving passion. The second is that we're a lay organization. We're committed to the proposition that God can use ordinary men and women and make a difference in the reality of the world where they live. And we have three dimensions that mark us. And those dimensions are first, evangelism, sharing Christ with those who don't know Christ, who don't know Him. Person-to-person discipling to help them grow and multiply. And a focus on knowing, studying, and applying the Bible in our lives. And that's why we have a guy like Howie Hendricks here, because he bases what he says on the Scriptures. That has been bedrock to the Navigators since the beginning. And I would like to just introduce to you the wife of the founder of the Navigators, Dawson Troutman, Mrs. Lila Troutman. Lila, would you stand, please? Thank you. And I want to tell you that that same passion still vibrates through every fiber of Lila's body. If you talk to her, you know that this passion is on her heart and that it has been there for a long time. But life changes, and the world changes, and the Navigators change. Because as the reality we live in changes, we need to make some adjustments. Now, we'd like to share with you some of the things that we're doing throughout the world, where we have a staff of over 3,100 and work in 72 countries. In reality, we're a missions agency, sending men and women from one country to another all over the world. And then the driving force in the hearts and minds of our people, the ethos of why we do much of what we do, is because of the nations. The Great Commission, to reach every nation in the world with the gospel of Christ. And our particular contribution, we believe, is to develop a lay disciple-making movement in each of these countries, which is self-sustaining and self-supporting. Today I would like to have two of the three men who work directly with me to share with you on some aspects of the international ministry, what we call our resident international team. Donald McGilchrist and Jim Peterson are here. Paul Stanley has just joined our team, having come from the U.S., and he is away on a trip this weekend. In fact, he's a new grandfather, to be honest with you. A little child was born a few days ago, and he's headed back for first priorities. You'll hear first from Donald McGilchrist. Donald came to Christ as an adult in Great Britain. He was an executive with the British Rail Corporation, and he worked in our international office with Lauren Sanney, who preceded me, and now works with us. He's been here a total of 15 years. Donald will give an overview of our work as well as some of the specifics. Jim Peterson, who will follow Donald, spent 23 years as a missionary in Brazil, developing our ministries in Brazil and all of Latin America. He returned to the U.S., rather reluctantly, I might say, to work with our international team in 1984. So, Donald, come up and share, and then Jim.
Good morning. My intention this morning is to share with you a brief summary of the progress that the Lord has graciously granted to the Navigators around the world. And I want to make two preliminary points as I start. And the first is that this ministry that the Lord has given us is extremely varied, and I will be forced to omit a number of stories of the diversity and multiplicity of God's grace and of what is happening around the world, and just concentrate on some general summaries. But let me mention that, for example, as regards fruitfulness, at one end of the spectrum of fruitfulness is the ministry that we have in Bologna, in northern Italy, where for five or more years our Dutch leader of that team has only seen two or three people come to Christ in 5 years. Italy is extremely hard soil. At the other end of the spectrum would be South Korea, where every year more than 5,000 of the people who come under the ministry of the Navigators give their lives to Christ and go on with Him. So there is a tremendous range in fruitfulness and in other dimensions. Secondly, I want to speak primarily this morning of the Navigators, without taking time to set ourselves in the context of the wider work of the Kingdom of God. And please do not hear this as arrogance. We do understand the limited and the specialized nature of our calling, and we do cooperate joyfully with many churches and many agencies around the world. First, then, the purpose to which God has called us, our primary aim, to multiply spiritual laborers in every nation. And we have been directed by the Holy Spirit to try to do this through three essential and biblical processes, what Jerry called three dimensions: evangelizing, establishing, and equipping. And our leadership team in each country moves ahead and plans and prays and comes up with their own specific strategies in the light of this umbrella, this overarching aim to which we have all committed ourselves. Now, because we are a missions agency, the circuit on this chart would not be complete if we were just engaging in evangelizing, establishing, and equipping. We must also conclude with cross-cultural sending. We would not be in 72 countries now if our American ancestors in the Navigators had not sent and sent to country after country. What is a laborer? The laborers that we seek to multiply. A laborer is a Christian disciple who is actively engaged in evangelizing the lost and discipling the saved. Jesus said that the harvest was plentiful and the laborers are few. That situation still pertains, and we are seeking to do something about it. We are, as Jerry observed a few minutes ago, a lay movement. But we cannot keep track of the number of lay men and women with whom we minister and whom we have the privilege of influencing and being influenced by. So instead, as a poor second, as the 1 ounce instead of the 10 pounds that Howie talked about, let's look at our staff. We have around the world somewhat over 3,000 staff. And during the last decade, they have been increasing by approximately 6% per year. 44 nationalities of staff. And you can imagine that this makes for a stretching diversity because of all the cultures, all the contexts. We're hanging grimly onto the fact that we still want to communicate internationally as a missions agency in English. But we may be overwhelmed soon because in a number of our countries, our nationals are not fluent in English, and so we are learning a lot about the interplay of culture. The fastest growth in the last decade as regards our staff has been in Africa and Asia, in the developing world, and this is basically true of the Church of Christ as a whole. This year, there's an exciting milestone that you see on the chart. For the first time, we have the privilege of ministering in more than 100 languages. And there's been a very rapid increase in the linguistic ability of our ministries during the last 10 years. Well, how are we organized? Our organizational entities basically are still countries. And we have decided to call ourselves in the last few years a global society. Now, Webster's Dictionary defines society as a voluntary association of people who freely unite for a common purpose. That describes us accurately. We freely unite to pursue a common purpose. The basic structure of our partnership is shown on the slide. We have Jerry as a general director, and we have, working with him, an international team. Most of the members of this team are spread around the world in the countries for which they are responsible. Once a year, in a formal way, the team comes together with others, and we meet as an international council. And then that is how we link up and shepherd and sustain the ministry in the 72 countries. Of these 72 countries, 24 are what we call established. That is, countries in which the ministry is no longer dependent in any sense at all on outside influences. Countries, in fact, where the ministry that God gives us is biblically rooted, culturally relevant, and continuously effective in terms of our aim. You see, without biblical roots, a ministry will not endure. Without cultural relevance, a ministry will be superficial. And we are committed to a gospel which has to be mobile and has to be pure. And therefore, these countries and the men and women in them are the carriers of the good infection within the Navigators, the interdependent partners that are at the heart of our society around the world. They are shown on this chart in dark blue. Historically, as you know, the Navigator ministry originated in the USA and it then spread throughout the English-speaking world, and now we have established countries on each continent. Most recently, last year, Mexico and Nigeria were added to the number. Now, this map should remind us of the command of Jesus Christ, go and make disciples in every nation. What does nation mean? Well, you know, and I know, that it means something more than country. In fact, in the book of Revelation, there are seven fourfold references to the people who will be standing around the throne of God in heaven, praising the Lord God. And three Greek terms are used in each of those seven references. The word ethnos, or nation, the word laos, or people, and the word glossa, or language. Now, the most general and elastic of these terms in Greek is ethnos, or nation. It's used of platoons of soldiers. It's used of swarms of bees. It's a very useful word and a very general word. It's the word in Matthew 28 in the Great Commission. What about countries? Well, the Apostle John was writing to urban fellowships within a province of an empire, so he wasn't at all bothered about countries. Countries are a rather recent phenomenon in the history of mankind. So we need to filter into this as well, countries. And it's clear that we want to reach every ethnos or nation, and it's also clear that there are three useful ways of thinking about the nations, in terms of their ethnicity or peoplehood, in terms of the language that they speak, and in terms of the passport that the men and women hold, their country. And strategically, our objective is to raise up spiritual laborers in the major nations of the world. Here is what we mean by major nation, using this triad of people, language, country. A major nation is a population of at least 1 million persons in the year 2000 who can be described as a people or as a language or as a country. Three complementary streams. Now, when we bring these together and cancel out the obvious overlap, my language is English, my country is England, my passport says England, so I only count once, not three times. When you take out that overlap and do some calculations, you'll come up with something rather similar to this. We believe that there are 440 major nations, over 1 million people, in the world today, or there will be by the year 2000. And you can see the number of peoples and languages and countries that flows into that estimate. How are we doing? Well, the navigators have a presence, at least the beginnings of a disciple-making ministry, in 115 out of these 440 major nations. Thinking about the Great Commission this way gives us a focus and an agenda. And, not least, it brings us much closer to the covenantal promise of blessing that God gave through Abraham, that he would be, and his descendants would be, a blessing to the nations. What do we need to do? We're only in 115 out of 440 nations, and in many of those 115, our ministry is only just beginning. Well, there are several ways of answering that question. Let me just show you one. Here are the largest nations, defined in terms of countries, for convenience, in which the navigators do not yet have a presence. The exciting thing at this point is to note that in four of the top five, the largest countries in the world, namely Pakistan, Bangladesh, Vietnam, Turkey, and Iran, in four of those five, we are actively planning, we have done surveys, and we intend to enter those countries with a navigator ministry within the next year or so. For example, Turkey within the next 3 months, shortly followed, Lord willing, by Vietnam. So you can see that we are tracking on the major places in the world that the Lord has not yet opened a ministry for us. How do we do this? We do this in many ways, but one of the significant ways, as you will realize, is through field surveys, through grassroots navigator lay people and staff people going into a country and sensing what the Spirit of God is doing there already and where there are opportunities and challenges that we could particularly respond to. In the last 16 months, we have made surveys in the 15 countries that you see listed there. So we are in a period of intense activity in terms of the preparation for our future missions program. What really satisfies me about this chart, however, is the lower portion of the chart, because these field surveys are not initiated here from Colorado Springs, but they have sprung up from our grassroots ministries, and I have shown there 9 nationalities of people who have been involved, led by the Lord in their own countries, to take part in these field surveys. For example, the Malaysians have been surveying Bangladesh, and the Costa Ricans have been surveying Guatemala. And we are unearthing some interesting things. Malaysians do not need a visa to enter Bangladesh. It's extremely hard for Americans and Englishmen to enter Bangladesh, particularly if you announce that you're a missionary at the border. But a Malaysian can go right in, and there are historic reasons for that. So we learn, and we survey, and we spread the responsibility for the nations among our whole partnership. During the 1980s, we have been able to launch a ministry in 3 new countries on average each year. Sometimes more, sometimes less. 1990, in fact, was a fairly good year. You will see that we entered Tanzania, Sudan, Swaziland, Cameroon. Different types of ministry. The ministry in northern Sudan, for example, is an itinerant medical ministry, but it is a disciple-making ministry. That is our calling. That is our aim. In recent years, we have made a concerted effort to move especially with a focus on what we call restricted countries. That is, countries in which the spreading of the gospel is prohibited, or local believers are imprisoned, or missionaries are turned back at the border, things of this nature. And in this turbulent world, which is getting more turbulent, as you are well aware, there are approximately 76 significant countries where we could legitimately call them restricted. Because these countries include India and China, they add up to about 2/3 of the population of the whole world, and almost 4 out of 5 unbelievers. So this is for serious. Our attention to these restricted countries is foundational to our faithful stewardship of the Great Commission. We are expanding fast in these countries and deliberately. You'll see from the right-hand side of the chart that we have been increasing the number of staff committed to these countries recently by some 17% per year, which compares with the total growth of our staff that I showed you of some 6%. Now, we do this as a partnership. And one of my responsibilities is to have overall responsibility for this thrust into restricted countries. We want to stimulate and empower and celebrate the ministry that God is giving us in these hard places of the world. We do this through something that we call Project Access. Again, it's a partnership of commitments, not of talk, not of surveys, but of commitments of men and women as individuals to go and live in these hard places. And it is a commitment to secure and sustain authentic presence in these places in contexts that will not accept traditional Christian workers. Now, notice authentic presence. Two points here. Authenticity and incarnation. Answering the questions, are you relevant and are you real? Authenticity and incarnation, 2 rather long words, but basically we're talking about what we navigators for years have called the with him principle. Jesus spent hours and hours and hours with his disciples. We are not going to have a long-range ministry lobbing things into Bangladesh. We are going to live among the Bangladeshis. And we are living in 26 of these 76 countries. This is our specialty. We have been resident, for example, in India for 15 years. We have been resident in the Soviet Union and Central Europe for at least 10 years. In China for at least 5 years. And thus, our ministries stay highly contextualized, fashioned by the interaction of the gospel and the culture. And Jim will give us a few illustrations of this. And when we do this, we can stay on the cutting edge of missions even when there is political turbulence. Incidentally, 9 of the 15 countries which we recently surveyed are restricted. Now, political restriction, of course, is not the only way to analyze the needs that we have in terms of the Great Commission. There are many other ways. Let me show you 6. We can talk about the frontiers, and we can talk about them in the 6 ways that you see listed there. Educational frontiers, religious frontiers, social frontiers. Howie is talking about some of the social frontiers right here in the USA, in this pagan relativistic culture. Whichever way you analyze They contain many unreached peoples, and to penetrate such cultures requires vision and courage and creativity. And the Lord has blessed many of our people with these gifts. So in summary, again, our aim is to multiply spiritual laborers in every nation. We seek to do this very humbly and very much in dependence upon God's grace and His empowerment. There are many issues that confront us. There are many needs and challenges to which we as yet see no answer. And your prayers and your participation are truly vital. This is not our thing. This is something that we are all called to, for we are a lay movement. We look out into the harvest fields and we see the same people as Jesus saw, just as harassed, just as helpless, and we covet your prayers. Nothing could be more exciting, to my mind, than this mission and this calling. Thank you.
The theme of this conference is making a permanent impact on a secular culture. By secular, we mean a culture that gets along without God, that operates without God as a part of its frame of reference. And what we're talking about here is the West. It's the United States, it's Western Europe, and then also, of course, Central Europe and the Soviet Union have lived with a secular religion for the past, Central Europe 40 years, Soviet Union 70 years. And so a large swath of our world is secular. I'm sure that Terry Taylor, as he talks about the U.S. work tomorrow, will get into this a little bit more. But we're also involved with the frontiers. And by frontiers, we mean those nations where the great religions of the world, which would be Buddhism, Shintoism, Hinduism, Islam, Confucianism, where they have become a part of the social fabric of that particular nation. And the fact is that the Christian church has not successfully penetrated any of these particular religions. We do pretty well with the animists. In places where people will worship something that's less structured, more towards superstition. And so in Africa, in Indonesia, in places like that, the gospel seems to make quite a bit of headway. But in these other places where the major religions are entrenched, the gospel has not penetrated. Now, as Donald said, we are committed to all nations, and so that is not good enough. We can't just write it off and say, that's too difficult. We'll go where things are ripe and reap where we can. The fact that we're sent to all nations ends that discussion. But why has the gospel not made progress in these nations? In reading the history of Christianity by Paul Johnson, he makes a very interesting observation. He said, what was the failure of Christianity? It was the inability of Christianity to de-Europeanize itself which caused it to miss its opportunities. The church presented itself as the extensions of European social and intellectual concepts rather than as embodiments of universal truth. Though Christianity was born in Asia, when it was re-exported there from Europe, from the 16th century onward, it failed to acquire an Asian face. Simply put, what he's saying is that the gospel, because it has been integrated into Western culture and has picked up just a lot of Western clothing and wrappings, it becomes objectionable to the people that we want to reach. It is not the essence of the message that they are objecting to as much as it is the wrappings that we bring it to those people in. And so what happens is that people, as they face the gospel, it is being Western, and they say, I don't want to leave my own society. And they shouldn't have to. But, you know, it's very difficult to present a pure gospel. But we, the navigators, are committed to cutting
a path into these nations with the gospel. And we are hard at work at that. We see ourselves as a part of the church, as a part of the body of Christ, in a pioneering or an apostolic function. Where we go to places where the gospel is has not been established, and we work at seeing it established. And as Donald said, our basic approach is to go in, live among the incarnation and the explanation of the gospel when we're in these places. And also, as Donald said, we don't want to give the impression that we're the only ones doing this, because there are others that are at work going into these frontiers, not many. But there are others, and we are giving ourselves to it. Let me illustrate what this involves, because this is really a very difficult thing that we're trying to grapple with. I've been involved in India over the past 4 years, and I've been in and out of there several times. There are 900 million, the population of India is 900 million. 800 million of these people are Hindu. And you're not going to get 800 million people to go Western. And so if you are going to make a penetration with the gospel into India, you have to accept the fact that we are going to have to adjust and bring a pure gospel in that will flow within the Hindu society. Now, our team there consists of an Australian, a Scotsman, and about 30 Indians, half of them of Hindu background themselves. Now, Hinduism, as you look at it, it's a tough thing to crack. 5,000 years of history. It goes way back to the Canaanite religions. And they have their system worked out. They have their scriptures. They have good explanations for even the hard things in life. 60 million gods, you can take your pick. I mean, some of them are nice, some of them are bad, some of them are evil. But nobody can handle 60 million gods, so everybody picks out about 30 that they deal with. And they spend their lifetimes kind of keeping an equilibrium between these 30 gods that they have on their shelves. And so if you go to one for a while, you've neglected this other one. This other one gets pushed out of shape, and so you have to go to the priest and get him to offer a puja, which is a kind of a little sacrifice, and it costs you money, to keep this other god happy. And so life is spent keeping the gods on an even keel and keeping everything peaceful. And you spend money you don't have, the money you should be using to eat on. You're buying candles and incense. So there's just a lot of poverty that controls the nation because of the religious belief. The hard questions. You see a person in the gutter, and he is sick and he's dying. You don't have to worry about him. That's his karma. He has it coming. And so you go on. There's no compassion. Better luck next time. If he suffers well this time, when in his next reincarnation, he's going to have a better deal. And so you don't have to worry about that. And the objective of the whole thing is to attain Atma, which is union with the eternal bliss. That's not heaven. It's oblivion. Finally, we can get out of this rat race into oblivion, where there's no consciousness. And so you say, well, this system is enslaving. And it really is. These people live enslaved to this system. And that's what the scripture says about the religions, is that they do enslave. But they don't see their religion as being enslaving. And all of us, in some way or another, are enslaved to certain things. Howie was talking about the legalism. That's the type of enslaving that we evangelicals tend to fall into. And so as they look at Christianity, they see that we have brought in a number of things that are marginal, like requirements for dress, requirements for diet, certain customs and traditions that Christianity rejects. And so to become a Christian means to leave this 5,000 years of tradition and to become a Westerner. It just doesn't sell. But there are some real problems involved. To illustrate one, a young man comes to Christ. And by coming to Christ, he begins to live according to the scriptures. His life has changed. He begins to be a better son, a better brother, a better student, a better member of the clan and everything else, and the family likes that. But they begin to worry about him, and they have reason to worry. Because the custom is that mom and dad choose your mate. And so when marriage time comes along, mom comes along to the son and says, well, son, we want to choose your husband for, or your mate for you, your wife. And he thinks about that and says, no way. I don't want a wife that's going to spend her life trying to keep 30 gods happy. And besides, the Bible talks about that, not being unequally yoked together. So what do I do about that? I come home and I'm expecting the smell of rice and curry, but she spent the money on candles and incense. And so we don't eat because we're keeping the gods happy. And so he says, thanks, but no thanks. And when he rejects that step by the parents, he becomes an outsider. And that's one of the things that has perpetually kept the gospel outside of the Hindu society. Well, as has been mentioned, we've been in India for 15 years, and we've struggled with this over and over again, prayed much about it. About a year and a half ago, I was in India, and one of these young men who was facing this issue, his mother said to him, Sugumar, if your God is who he said who you say he is, could you not trust him to lead us to choose a wife for you that will follow your Christ? Now, a thoroughly Hindu family. So he came to me because I happened to be there, and he also came to John Ridgway, who lives there, and he said, what do you think about that? We said, well, let's pray. Let's proceed. Perhaps God is opening a door here. Well, it turned out that John became sort of the intermediary between the two families as they negotiate this wedding. And all kinds of money flows between the two families because the father has to pay to get rid of his daughter. And so this man is getting married. He rakes it in. I mean, he'll pick up a couple $100,000 just marrying this girl. Well, I was there now in September, and on September 21st, we had a wedding. And it was the girl that Sugumar's mother had picked out for him. He'd only seen her a couple times before. It was a step of faith. We were all scared out of our wits. And the ceremony, lo and behold, was held in a church. We couldn't believe it. And the father of the bride, who is the one who puts on and pays all the bills and so on, wealthy man in town, had found a Hindu convert to Christ who had hung on to his Hindu forms. And he conducted the ceremony in Hindi. I couldn't understand it. But it was in the typical Hindu pattern. And it was kind of like a Hindu Harry Belafonte, because he would talk for a while, and then he'd lapse into these exquisite songs. And there were flower petals, about a half a ton of flower petals, floating around in the room. And then we retired, walked across about half the town there in Bangalore to this club where they had a sit-down meal for 5,000 people. Well, nobody had seen anything like it in the town. Even our guys, these 30, they just shook their heads. They said, we've never seen anything like this. And both families are interested. They're open to the gospel. The next morning, or next afternoon, Sugumar and his new bride, Dava, came over to where I was. And he sat down. They sat down and they said, well, Jim, now that we're married, what advice do you have for us? And so I said, well, you're never going to make it if you don't have Christ in the middle of your marriage. And so I went into Ephesians chapter 5, began to describe what that really involved. And Dava, bright young gal, has her master's degree teaching in a university. She sat there and just glowed, obviously really responding to Christ, excited about Christ. So we have a breakthrough. We think But these are the kinds of things we find ourselves dealing with over and over again when we find ourselves working on the frontiers. What is required for people who work on the frontiers is two things. One is an unusual grasp of the scriptures. If a person working on this level does not have a really fresh, unusual grasp of the scriptures, you know what they'll do? They'll go back and do what was done in the past. They'll copy other missionaries, or they'll revert back to what they did in their home church, and it will not work. It'll keep them outsiders. When a person really grasps what the scriptures have to say, then they have freedom, all kinds of freedom, to innovate. And that's what it takes. The other thing I think it takes is the faith that gives the courage to cut new patterns and new paths. And that's what our job is in the RIT, is to help our people around in these countries develop this grasp of the scriptures and their faith.
I've been following that one in India, and I break out in a cold sweat every time I think about it. Particularly if you think of having 5,000 people, it hasn't changed, has it? The father of the bride still pays. That's something else. And Jim just went through that. His daughter just got married to a Brazilian, and it was quite a deal. Great. Thanks, Jim. You know, we just live in a world that is filled with opportunities and challenges. And you've heard a little of how we in our small world of the navigators are addressing some of them, and we are committed to a world that is falling apart at the seams. I'd like to just take a little time for you to ask some questions, and if I can't answer it, I'll pass it off to one of these guys. I'll even put on my glasses so I can see him. And if there's some questions you have about the navs, yes. So the question is, what is the difference in Korea, where it is so successful, but has not been elsewhere? I don't have an answer to that. All I can say is the Spirit of God. One thing I will say is those Koreans are committed, hard workers. You know, they work 8-day weeks, 40-hour days. I mean, really, if you've ever been in Korea, and the Spirit of God, and then prayer. They are committed to prayer. Jim?
I'd like to give an answer to that. I think that a lot of it had to do with when Sigmund Reed came in and took the presidency. I think it was in 1949, something like that. The first thing he did when he took the presidency was he stood and led his parliament to prayer, in prayer to God. And so their freedom, they attach it to this...